Coming up on this episode of DL Weekly, a new Trader Sam's mug has arrived for a limited time. The Candlelight Processional is almost here.
New Magic Key Holder merchandise, an unusual sight on It's a Small World. We talk to author Marcy Character Smothers and more. DL Weekly starts now.
Howdy, partners. For your safety, remain seated with your hands, arms, feet, and legs inside the podcast. And be sure to watch your ears. If any of you folks are wearing hats or glasses, best remove them, because Tag and Teresa have the wildest ride in the wilderness.
Hello and welcome to this episode of DL Weekly for the week of November 29th, 2023. I'm producer James.
And I'm Tag Bushman. We'd like to send a thank you to all of the current weekly tiers, including Lisa W., Olivia C., Donna L., and Jillian E. for supporting the show. Without your support, DL Weekly would not be possible. Your support ensures that the podcast will continue and that we can make it to the parks more often to bring you the latest news and information direct from the parks. Also, I just finished it today, putting together all of the postcards that are going to go out. So those are going to go out in the next week or so. So if you are a supporter and you have an address on file, you should be getting one of those in the next couple weeks. If you would like to become a weekly tier yourself, head on over to dlweekly.net/support to sign up.
Those postcards do look great. And if you enjoy listening to the show and think other Disney fans should become weekly tiers and listen to the show, becoming part of our community, give us a rating over on iTunes or the podcast app of your choice and use. It really helps spread the Disney word.
Now let's get to the news. Well, by the time you hear this, a new item will likely be sold out. Trader Sam's has a new holiday mug that went on sale at 6 a.m. through mobile order on November 29th. The new mug will only be available on that date. The mug looks like a red wine barrel with bits of snow that have fallen on it, and with the Trader Sam's logo and other nautical and holiday ornamentation as well.
I think it's wild to have a one-day sale. Like, I feel like this is like the Starbucks comparison of the Red Cup Day that everyone gets really excited
about. That's a thing.
Oh, yeah. Every year, people are like, what's the Starbucks cup going to be? I mean, I think it's become a little bit more muted, a little less exciting in past years.
Sure.
Not that I'm a coffee drinker, so that doesn't really help my case to tell you about it. So just one day, I think this is crazy.
It's crazy. What do you think of the mug?
I think the mug looks really cool. The red on the wood barrel is such a unique choice, especially compared to what I'm used to for Trader Sam's, but it really lets the rest of the brown on the wood look nice. I love the snow effects that come with it. It's such a unique take on what I expect for Tiki Mug.
Yeah, it's definitely different. I do like the holiday theme. I'm kind of sad that these things are, in this case, this is only a one-day thing. I wish they would just produce more of these and not make it like a, I don't know. It seems like they make it this whole big thing where it ends up that everybody kind of fights over trying to get something. Or in this case, like you wake up at the crack of dawn and you mobile order and you got to go through all this stuff. It just seems like a lot of extra effort and stuff that Disney, I don't know, they could make more money if they just made more of these things and stopped having people have to like fight over it.
Doesn't it just take you back to the days of trying to get a boarding pass on Rise of the Resistance? You just imagine everyone's on their app like refreshing, please let me into the store.
I don't know. I mean, I'm glad, I guess, that it is on mobile order instead of having to wait in like a line that may open up like the night before or something like that. So I guess that's a plus.
I find it interesting. I don't know if I missed it, but it doesn't come with like a drink. And I feel like every other piece of merch or things like that has always had something to go with it. Now, I typically think about like popcorn bucket and that always gets you some popcorn with it. But I think this is genuinely just the cup.
Yeah, sometimes they do it that way. Some of these ones that you order through mobile order usually don't come with anything. I could be wrong, but I think in the past that's what it has been.
And that's probably just managing the inventory at that point, not so much of a, here's your pickup window.
Plus the pickup window could be earlier, and you don't want people drinking at like 11 a.m., but maybe.
Yeah, true. Well, preparation is underway for the Candlelight Processional taking place this weekend at Disneyland. We've already covered tips on how you can experience the holiday tradition if you aren't an invited guest. If you're going to be in the parks this weekend, be ready for some congestion. It's definitely going to get crowded, especially at the front of Disneyland before, during, and after the processional.
Yeah, so this is one of those things that definitely is on my bucket list at some point to go see. I think it's going to be a whole day of waiting when we do it. We did have a episode, I believe it was Stephanie, that was able to go and actually experience this, I want to say last year. and we had her on a little bit and talked about how you could get it. Basically, you show up in the morning and you basically have to sit there most of the day and you make friends with people around you so you can get up and go do maybe one or two things throughout the day and you're not just stuck sitting there. I don't know. It's kind of a cool thing. Obviously, it's been a tradition for a very, very long time. We don't have any idea who the narrators are going to be. They usually keep that under wraps until right before the first performances because there are two performances each night. They already have some walls up at the train station, but as we all know, more and more stuff is just going to pile into the town square there. You know, I do think this is a better venue than like Epcot has. Epcot has like, they do it in this venue, but there's something just magical for me about it being on the train station at the end of Main Street. Although I'm sure it's an operational nightmare for that one weekend. So again, if you're going to be around this coming weekend on the 2nd and 3rd, I would just try to avoid it as much as possible.
Yeah, operational nightmare. Let's put the biggest crowded event at the entrance and exit of the park. That is wild.
I mean, and there's no other, you know, even the walkways that are behind the Main Street buildings, doesn't matter. It dumps out into the town square where this is happening. So there really is no alternative.
No, but I mean, this is what you got to do, because otherwise you're going to shut down the hub by the castle as the other spot that seems like it would fit for kind of that magical experience that you're trying to get. And that just seems just as poor to take away the castle, the icon of the park. So immerse yourself in this. I do have to say, from my point of view, I don't go to the park enough to feel like I could justify going in for the day and just sitting and people watching for hours and hours to watch what, you know, essentially feels like a parade, albeit, you know, extra magic with huge choir, great experiences. And
story of Christmas.
Yeah. But for me, I'm not quite there yet. It's a long running tradition. What has this been going basically since the park's been open?
For a long time, since Walt's time, for sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, super cool. Love the legacy behind it, but not for me.
Well, Magic Key holders have some new holiday merchandise to choose from. A phone case, headphone case, and magnet are available with a holiday design featuring a vintage-looking Mickey and Minnie with some gifts and some other characters on the phone case. Only items range from $14.99 to $34.99.
I'm kind of surprised there's not a pin mixed in with this one.
Right?
I feel like that's kind of the go-to merch thing that really fits in here. But, you know, the three things we got, I feel like they're fine designs by all means. Putting the characters in a new art with some typical holiday related things, the gifts and whatnot, it's always nice to update and see something a little bit different.
I'm not that excited about any of this except for the magnet, mostly because I had a case on my AirPods, but decided that like I don't really need one. And then the phone case, I'm currently not doing a case on my phone, but I find that the problem with the phone cases that they have, the D-Tech ones, are that they seem to always have the wrong size or something. Mm-hmm. Obviously, especially if you're like an Android user, it's unless you have like one of the most popular models of Android phone, you're not going to find a case that's going to fit. And even if you have an iPhone, sometimes you can't find a case that fits either. So it just seems like an interesting thing. I'd go for the magnet. The magnet is $14.99. You know, I guess it's nice that they have some cool Magic Key stuff. I feel like they could do so much more and they just aren't.
I find it interesting that with the branding on it, that there's so much more emphasis on Magic Key versus Disneyland, because I feel like that's like a distinct in-group that knows Magic Key is the cool thing versus generically Disneyland for people that will probably see you in everyday life with using your phone. Like, they'll see the characters, they'll see Magic Key, and I would imagine my first thought is that like a new series or something?
Yeah. Yeah. But I think the people that are going to care and know. No.
Yeah, that's true. For me, it's always just kind of that legacy of like, you see Club 33 on merchandise and you know when you know with that one.
Right, but do other people who don't go to Disneyland know what Club 33 is?
You know what? That's a really good point.
Same thing.
Yep. I think you just won me over.
There we go.
With the new debut of the new Disney animation film Wish this weekend, a new popcorn bucket and sipper have arrived to the park to celebrate. The popcorn bucket is themed after the character Valentino from the movie, and the sipper is Star. Valentino is a small brown goat wearing an orange shirt. The Wish Star sipper is shaped like the Star character and features a yellow painted face on a sparkling yellow body. We're going to see this movie after recording, but before this comes out. So it's kind of a shame that we can't be like, oh my God, I love this part about that. But
yeah, I think the Valentino character looks funny. He's got an expression on his face that just kind of seems kind of dubious or something like that. I didn't actually notice that he was wearing a shirt or a sweater or whatever until I was writing this and there was a description online. And I was like, oh, that is a shirt, isn't it? There's something about this sipper, though, and this character from the movie, from the previews and stuff I've seen, that there's just something about this star character that just seems fun. Although it reminds me of,
say the Super Mario Brothers movie.
Was it the Super Mario Brothers movie? That's what I keep thinking. It was the star that was caught in the cage, right? That was like, we're all going to die.
Death is here.
Yeah. So that's maybe what I was thinking of. So that's kind of funny that Disney, of all places, are going to have this. But I don't know. What do you think? This isn't a popcorn bucket that I'm necessarily going to go for. The sipper, maybe. The sipper's kind of cool.
I think the sipper's pretty cute. I like the idea of it. I don't know if it glows a little bit, right? Like there's a small light effect with it.
Lights up, yep.
Yeah, I feel like that would be a necessity with that one. I think that one puts it for me as like I'd like to see it and would definitely consider that one. I'm with you on the goat though. I think Valentino's not enough for me, but it might change when we see the movie. You have a tendency of falling in love with the animal companions in these movies.
That's true.
So I could easily see Valentino stealing your heart, but I don't know if it's enough. Like the popcorn bucket isn't that big thing.
Valentino, he may or may not be the new Hey Hey for me. I don't know.
It's true. But, you know, you've got a lot of popcorn buckets at this point, too. So that probably brings your threshold up a little bit.
It's hard to carry him back to Wisconsin from California. Yeah. Well, hopefully the movie will be good. I know that it seems like the fans have rated the movie very well, where the movie critics have not rated it as well. But and it performed poorly at the box office this weekend. But I think one of the things that I saw online that would explain this is I think people have now been conditioned that in 45 days it's going to be on Disney Plus. So why go see it when you could just wait and it's already part of something you've already paid for?
Yeah, because there's definite argument for what's worth going to the theater now with the prices and the time and whatnot that it really takes.
And I think most animated movies are not necessarily things that you need to see in a theater. I think something like Lion King, because that the stampede scene is something that's really good in the theater. But I just don't know if a lot of other Disney animated movies are things that I need to, like, do you get a benefit? Like, the Marvel movies, I feel like you get a benefit because they're big and grand and sound and all of that. But I feel like for a lot of the movies, it's not, I can get just as much from watching it on my small screen, which a lot of people have big screens now, but you know what I mean?
I think the argument for that to be made more so is kind of the audio and what you expect from the music experience or something. You know, Frozen has all those anthemic songs. They're big, they're loud, they're in your face. That's why things like Into the Unknown and Let It Go became iconic Disney songs, because they have that feeling that goes with it. And they haven't really pushed the music with Wish. I haven't seen it take on any sort of like big cultural thing in the couple days that's been out. Obviously, we might have a different experience after going. But for me, that's, I think, what would sell it more than just the picture itself.
Sure. Well, fans of the Dapper Dans may want to add a new item to their gift lists. A new knit polo shirt in the theme of the Dapper Dans has arrived on Main Street at Disneyland. Polo is $78 and features a repeating red pinstripe pattern across the front and back, stopping at the sleeves to simulate the appearance of Dapper Dan's vest.
This feels like a shirt that producer Vern would be considering.
I don't know if he likes... It's kind of like a sweatery polo.
It's got a collar, which is like a big win for him in a lot of these shirts.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like he's probably more into like the Hawaiian-y shirts that have more of the pattern versus this. But tying it into something very much that he enjoys of the street entertainment, you know, it's just always a thing for him.
He does love the Dapper Dans.
So I thought maybe that one would win. For me, I'm not sure. I don't know if I like the pattern and look of it enough, but I feel like it might also be one of those shirts that looks way different when it's on somebody versus when it's on a hanger.
I will say they did post a photo in the article we have linked in the show notes further down that just talk about the Dapper Dans in general. And I'm looking at their vest and I'm like, you know, if they just sold a vest, like just a regular vest that was the colors of the Dapper Dans, like, I would buy the purple vest. Like, I love vests. I love the purple. There's a purple Dapper Dan. I think it'd be great. But I don't know. There's something about this polo that just isn't working for me, but I'm sure it'll work for somebody.
Yeah. This is my surprised face and voice of you saying the purple one is the best.
Well, yeah. I mean, maybe if this was, I don't, but you know what? I don't even think if it was in purple, I'd be interested in it. It's just, I don't like the cut of it or something. I don't know. It's, there's just something about it that's just not appealing to me.
But you know what the win is for? It is different Disney merch inside the park celebrating something that is the park itself.
Yeah, total win.
Ugh, on the total flip side, total loss, obviously. Fans of the oversized candy bar at the Pym Test Kitchen may be disappointed at the following news. The Choco Smash Bar is now the Choco Smash Cake. Gone is the candy bar shape and presentation, and now it's in the form of a slice of cake made from the same ingredients. According to Mice Chat, that size of the cake slices, they're all over the place, but hopefully cast members will be able to get it right in the new format and make it a nice, consistent experience.
So I was wondering about this because the last time that we were at the park, I actually wanted to order one of these bars and it was unavailable. And so I didn't know if maybe that they weren't going to have it anymore. And now they've got this cake. I do feel like maybe the cake is going to be easier to eat than the Choco Bar was, but man, the idea of it was so awesome. I don't know why they wouldn't just make it this way.
The Choco Bar was absolutely massive. You needed your
You tasted it, right?
Oh, yeah, it was very good, but you needed your five best friends to finish that thing. This piece of cake looks much more manageable for one or two people.
But how do you feel about the fact that that cake costs the same amount as the candy bar?
Oh, awful. I feel like it's such a takeaway. You don't get the candy bar wrapper presentation with it anymore. It's just like on a plate, like I'd get at any sort of birthday party. And to me, that's super disappointing because I loved the feeling of a giant candy bar breaking out of its package, just really buying into the Pym particles instead of just a piece of cake.
Like, yeah.
Whose birthday are we celebrating?
Pym, obviously.
He's getting kind of old if that's the case.
You know, when you get older, your portion sizes go down, so maybe that's why it's turned into the cake.
Ugh, should still enjoy the candy bar.
Yeah. Well, an unusual sight happened on It's a Small World this weekend. On Sunday afternoon, a guest who was reported as being under the influence of something climbed out of an It's a Small World boat, stripped down to his underwear, and then later stripped down to absolutely nothing, and climbed onto one of the sets in the attraction. The guest was escorted out of the attraction and promptly arrested by the Anaheim Police Department. He was charged with multiple accounts.
Things I never thought we would talk about at Disneyland for 1,000, Egg.
Yeah, sure.
This is just wild. Like, seeing the videos and hearing, like, the guests calling out to the person, like, sit down, don't touch it, you're gonna hurt the attraction and the pieces. It's like they understood what was really going on and how the magic was just gone because this person, I'm guessing out of their mind on something, decided it was going to be fun to go sit in front of the Taj Mahal.
Apparently. Yeah. So there's a couple of videos online of some of the things going through here. Apparently somebody who was on the attraction said that they were stuck on it for about an hour and 15 minutes after all of this went down. I'm going to try to find it to put it in the show notes, but there was a link to somebody who put all of the kind of steps of this happening. So the guy getting out of the boat, then there was him in his underwear sitting on the thing. Then there was some shots from outside when he had gotten outside of the attraction, actually, but still had not been wrangled by people yet, but was completely naked at that point. And then him being literally carried away and off stage by the Anaheim Police Department and some cast members, completely naked. So I don't know, something was not right going on there. They did say that he was under the influence of some stuff, so it is what it is. But wow,
it's just a shame. Like, Disneyland being a distinctly family experience park, that is something distinctly not family.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, that's something you never want to see. You hope that this person gets the help that they need for a lot of things. Probably never see the front entrance of Disneyland ever again.
Oh, no.
But, like, wow.
I'm surprised that he was able to sit on this without, like, breaking it. I thought that these things were a lot more fragile than apparently they are.
I mean, they survived the mail going back and forth from the World's Fair.
I'm surprised that they carried him out this way and not, I don't know, I guess, I don't know what other way they'd carry him out, but yeah, he was just...
Yeah, because you don't necessarily want to go backstage.
I guess, but yep, he was just carried out. So I hope the guy gets the help he needs to, you know, whatever mental health or drugs or something he was on, and hopefully he can get some things together. But man, whew, that's something.
Pilots, we've detected some producer questions near Jakku. Report to your DL weekly vessels and make the jump to hyperspace. The 77 Squadron will provide support during your trivia mission. Good luck, and may the Force be with you.
Welcome to a special guest episode of Trivia Land.
Ooh.
I'm in the wrong chair.
Testing the knowledge of the usual Trivia Land master, James, along with Teg.
Along with me. I'm just here for the ride.
Well, you're a normal trivia answerer.
Sure.
Yeah,
it's special when James gets to answer the trivia.
I know. It's always so scary when I'm on this side, because I know what it's like to be on the other side, and I like having the answers and feeling
so nice
smart.
When you can look at the answer, isn't it?
It's scary to have to come up with those answers quickly.
I also want to say that joining us from Trivia Land this week is community manager Kate, who has been on the show before, in case you didn't recognize her voice. I just want to make sure that you were introduced so people know who this voice from beyond is.
Yes, I shouldn't assume that people know who I am.
Don't you know who I am?
So important. Okay, so with the Candlelight Candlelight Processional coming up this weekend at Disneyland, I thought I would test your knowledge of the history of this event.
Oh, you're going down the Vern trivia type of thing.
Oh, for four. Here I come.
I like a themed Trivia Land.
Okay. Well. Okay.
All right. I think you'll do okay.
Okay. I believe in you, Tay.
So the first Candlelight Processional, which included a celebrity narrator reading portions of the biblical Christmas story, took place in 1960. Who was the first celebrity narrator, and how many years did he or she narrate the event?
Oh, well, let's see. 1960. Who was a big deal in 1960? It's not like Ronald Reagan.
I feel like you pick like a voice that is associated with Christmas and all of those things that you want.
Who are you going to pick?
So I'm like, is
Bing Crosby?
Well, I mean, that's a good one. I was thinking more like Burl Ives is his name.
Sure.
I don't know why. I don't have any reason behind
Burl Ives. Is he the one that did all the like music and stuff for the CBS or whatever, NBC stop motion?
You know, I have no confidence that I have the name right, but I think that's
Burl
right.
Burl Ives is a person. Oh gosh, I don't know. Bing Crosby, only because that's another Christmassy kind of name that I know from maybe that era. I'm probably way off.
Just getting us to go on this thought, because you know we're so good at second guessing ourselves in Trivial Land.
Yeah,
would they pick like a familiar voice of something that we're used to hearing?
Well, like those things came out in the '60s, so it would have been like before they became like the thing for that.
Oh, maybe it was their audition.
I don't know, and I'm gonna say 3 years.
Oh, how long they did it for?
Well, that's what the second part of the question was.
How many years?
I got so stuck on that first one. I'll go with 7.
Okay.
Probably like 25.
I don't know. Probably not 25.
All right. So, James, you're saying Burl Ives in 7 years, and Tag, you have Bing Crosby for 3 years.
Sure.
Right on.
Okay. Question number 2. The Candlelight Processional at Disneyland typically takes place over 2 nights at Disneyland, but one year the event was expanded to 20 nights. What year did this expansion take place, and how many different celebrity narrators performed over the 20 nights?
So Teresa and I reported on this for the podcast, so there you go. That'll help you a little bit.
Oh, that gives a time frame.
So I think I want to say this was like 20... See, I always think 2019 for things, and then usually it ends up being 2018, but I actually think it was... No, that would have been right before COVID. 2018, I'll say. I'll say 2018, and you said how many nights did it go?
20.
How many different celebrity narrators?
Right, but it was over 20 nights?
Over 20 nights.
I think there was like... I'll say 8 celebrity narrators. My first inclination was 12, but I think that was too many.
Okay.
So I like your answer of 2018, because I think the processional really like officially started like 58, give or take. Granted, didn't have like the narrator and stuff. So that would be a clean like decade anniversary with
She just said when it started. It started in 1960.
With narrators.
Oh.
I think it kind of started when the park opened and it came a thing in 58.
No, I don't think it was the park opened.
Yeah, give or take.
The processional?
Yeah.
It started as just an event with a choir singing, and it kind of grew.
But what year did that start?
It started when the park opened.
Oh.
Ah.
Oh. I'm James from Trivia Land. I'm not used to being on this side, but then I totally know the answer. So
to be fair, they didn't call it the Candlelight Processional, but it was the same idea.
It's only because we had to talk about the candlelight.
You see what happens when you're on this side of the thing?
We gang up on you.
No, I'm just saying that you and I are starting to bicker. It's going to destroy the podcast.
Destroy the podcast. I'll go with 5 different readers.
5 different
readers. Everyone got 4 nights.
Ooh. You know that they read twice a night.
Oh, gosh. That's going to be a lot of reading for them. Maybe I should have gone with 10.
It is a lot of
reading.
Whatever.
We're going with 5. Okay. Gut instinct. So always the right choice.
Both of you were saying 2018, and Teg, you said 8, and 8. James, 5.
5.
Okay.
But my gut is saying maybe 12, so I just want to put that on the record, but I know that can't be my answer, Clarity City.
It's Trivial, and there's no rules here.
We'll give you a half point.
It's the Wild West.
Yeah. We're just getting crazy. I'm making up new rules.
Do you know Trivia Land is west of Big Thunder Mountain?
Oh, is it in that area that they're going to evict you from? Oh, but that's at Magic Kingdom.
That's
Magic
Kingdom, right?
Yeah.
All right, guys. Question number 3. Approximately how many choir members will be singing at this year's processional?
Oh, I just read this.
Me too.
Do you remember?
I do.
Is it like 200?
No.
600.
600. That's
600.
What I'm going to.
600. Because it was, we literally, for the news, just talked about this, and the article I clicked on said 600, but we didn't talk about 600 in the actual, anyway.
So either we get to look really silly, or...
We didn't say 600 people in the news.
That's
so
true.
All right, so 600 people is your, both of your guesses.
Yes.
You know, I kind of wish we would record a news after trivia, because we could have been like, did you know that it had 600? And then we end up being completely wrong for trivia. That'd be hilarious.
Oh my god!
Like, didn't they just say 600 a few minutes ago?
Oh, that would be a little awkward.
Spoiler alert for those people who don't understand how sometimes we put the podcast together. Sometimes, especially when Vern is doing trivia, we will generally record trivia before the news. So things get weird and out of order.
Sometimes you record it on different nights, even.
That's true. Yeah, like, man, who would record on, like, a Monday?
Oh, weird.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, so for the final question, I am going to name 5 different former narrators, and you will need to name the year that they narrated the event.
Oh. Spoiler alert, it's all 2018 or whatever. The one year was. Or one of them will be, like, the first year narrator. Like, she's just goading us.
Okay, I will give you the hint that none of these are people that narrated that year.
Okay.
So the first one is Olympia Dukakis.
Oh gosh, she was like known in, was she like the 80s? I'm gonna say 1988. It's just the first number that came to mind.
I have no idea who
you don't
that
know
is.
Who Olympia Dukakis is?
Nope. I know I've heard the last name.
I'm sure that when I type Olympia Dukakis into Google, it's not going to pull up anything.
She was
about the
in Steel Magnolias and Moonstruck. She was wonderful.
My youth is showing. I've heard of Steel Magnolias.
Olympia Dukakis. Oh, I don't know her either. Oh, she died in 2001.
Okay, I was wondering if there was a relation to Michael Dukakis, so that makes sense. So.
Anyway.
Okay, let's see. So Steel Magnolias, that's 70s or 80s probably. So
I think Steel Magnolias was the 80s.
Was it?
Or early 90s.
90s. Oh my god.
By the way, can I just say that Kate, we're recording this over Zoom, and Kate has this look of like, ugh, on her face, like you don't know when this was.
Not a clue.
I guess I'm not too shocked that you have not rewatched Steel Magnolias every year since your teenage years, like I have.
That gives us a hint.
Teenage years. Okay. Let's go with 1993. Kate's okay. Teenage years.
All right. Number two, Jimmy Stewart.
Oh, Jimmy Stewart. Jimmy Stewart must have been like, oh gosh. Well, what did I say before? I said 3 years was how long?
Person yes. For?
Okay. So I will say 19. Oh, wait, Jimmy. I don't know. When was Jimmy Stewart like a thing?
He's a musician, right?
I'm so worried that I'm going to say something and then they'll be like, he couldn't have done it. He was dead then or something. I'm going to just say 1971.
Oh, wow. That's what I was thinking, too.
Oh, well, then there you go. We both said 1971.
Okay.
I don't know if we've talked about this enough at how bad I am with like celebrities. And
oh, you're
names
terrible.
And things, so.
When we play charades, James always says it's who?
Matthew McConaughey.
Matthew McConaughey.
Always.
Always Matthew McConaughey.
I mean, that's a good guess in general.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's never Matthew McConaughey.
It never is.
He'll be right someday.
Because James will be like, it's that movie with Matthew McConaughey where he is on a submarine and he's defecting from Russia. And I'm like, you mean you're talking about Alec Baldwin? Yeah, him.
Yeah. I mean, they're totally the same.
Yeah. It's the one where he's a boxer, like they find him on the streets, he runs up the stairs in Philadelphia.
Oh my god, that's Sylvester Stallone, James.
I know that one.
Anyway.
Okay, I have number three is a celebrity that James might know.
Oh, we're only on number three?
Chris Hemsworth.
Chris Hemsworth, yeah.
Oh, he just did it, like 2000, what are we, 21, let's say. No, was Disneyland open for 21? Yes, they were open for 2021.
Wasn't that Lin-Manuel Miranda's year?
I don't know, James. All I remember is I think he made like a silly joke. Didn't he make a silly joke? Maybe that was the year that they had all of the different people that there was that silly joke. There was some silly joke.
I'm guessing this is coming more in the earlier Thor days.
Go ahead.
So I'm thinking like 2014.
Oh, no, it wasn't that early. I think it was the time we were doing.
I guess that might be late because that I don't remember when Disney bought Marvel.
Oh my goodness.
So anyway, accepting the wrong answer on that one. Carry on, Kate.
All right. Number four, Craig T. Nelson.
Awesome.
Craig T. Nelson. Oh, he was big in like the...
Oh, he was big in the 70s.
Was he?
I feel like I've watched him a lot on game shows where he was a celebrity frequently.
In the 70s?
I don't know. Maybe I'm thinking of someone else. You know how good I am with these celebrities.
Isn't Craig T. Nelson? Hold on. I just want to make sure this is the person I'm thinking of. Craig T. Nelson. I have this vision in my head. Yeah, that's who I'm thinking it is. Craig T. Nelson.
Yep, I'm definitely thinking of someone else. So this is good.
Are you thinking of Matthew McConaughey?
Yes, that's exactly who I was thinking of.
Oh. I'm going to say, because I think Craig T. Nelson was like 80s, early. I'm going to say 90s. I didn't say 93 for one of the other people, did I? That'd be embarrassing.
I don't think you did.
I don't think I did either. 93.
Okay, 93.
I'm going to go later. James? Let's go the last one before Y2K. 1999.
Ooh.
Okay, and finally, Charlton Heston.
Charlton Heston?
Oh, I know this one.
Yeah, I can barely say his name.
He's the Charlton big Heston. NRA guy, and he was in Planet of the Apes and everything.
60. He was an actor before he was the NRA guy.
You're right, yeah. But he was in Planet of the Apes, and that was kind of like the height of his thing, wasn't it?
So he was early on.
So I'm going to say...
I'm going to say 1968.
I'm going to say 69.
Okay. All right. After our discussion topic, we will see how you guys did and what your knowledge is of this event.
Not very knowledgeable.
How bad I am at history and people.
This week, we have a very special guest. Marcy Carricker Smothers is with us. She is not only a Disney Parks geek and big fan like us, she is an author as well as a historian. So welcome to the show, Marcy. We're very excited to chat with you.
Thank you guys for having me.
Of course. Well, let's start off like we do with everybody. And let's find out a little bit about you for our audience here. Tell us your Disney story. What got you interested in Disney or the parks? And this can be as detailed or as brief as you want it to be.
Well, going to Disneyland was always the best day of the year for me when I was a kid. And I have this theory, it's just my theory, when you don't have a happy childhood, when you get to go to Disneyland one time a year, it's like supersized. It's Technicolor on steroids. It's so special because it's so not your life. So not your life. So my grandparents raised me mostly, and they would, my grandfather sold pools. He drove a truck. He did so many humble jobs, but he would save up to take us. We'd go one day a year. I'd spend the night before I would lay out my outfit. And dating myself a little bit, but when we, back in the day, you could park, you know, where DCA is now. So, you know, and so I would remember, like, we would leave really early and who's the first person that sees the Matterhorn, all those traditions. He would lay out his blanket with his library books. I don't know what, how early, but so we'd have the best seats for the Main Street Electrical Parade. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and he would just wonder at the whole thing. I got one treat. No souvenirs because those were too expensive, but my treat was always chocolate fudge. And I never wanted the day to the end, but at midnight, you know, now I'm exhausted and I have these vivid memories of my grandfather carrying me out of Disneyland and putting me in his car. Aww. So that is really, I fell in love with Disneyland as a young girl. And it wasn't until I was an adult with my own baby, I think, that I first, you know, really started going back in the parks because, as you know, going with kids, whether they're yours or nieces or nephews or whatever, is just so fantastic. And that amplified it again. And that was long before I started running for Disney.
Wow.
That's so special. Yeah. I love that. Well, so when entering Disneyland on the first day of your visits now as an adult, which way do you like to go? Do you like to, do you kind of have a way you like to attack the parks? We usually go left towards Adventureland. That just seems to be what pulls us. But which, what's your way of attacking the park?
When I go through the turnstiles and I look up at Mickey Mouse and, of course, the marquee being the train, mm-hmm. I just give myself pause and say, thanks, Walt, every single time. Then, while it is traditional for people to go to the left side under the tunnel, I always go to the right. Mm-hmm. Then I, of course, you know, regale, take everything and walk down. And then I do the same. I go left. And it's mostly because of my signature traditional opening ride is Pirates of the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. So that is the direction that I am going to go in. But I definitely do. Now, when I pass Walt Disney's Enchanted Tiki Room, I always go in and I pray to find a stranger and have them dare to have called a tiki room in front of me so that I can correct them and say, it's Walt Disney's Enchanted Tiki Room. It's the only attraction at Disneyland with Walt's name on it. Mm-hmm. And Walt paid for the entire attraction himself, even especially when it was being developed as a restaurant. But later when it became the Enchanted Tiki Room, he sold it back at Disneyland on the day that the attraction opened. Oh. And it's very important to me to acknowledge Walt at his Enchanted Tiki Room. Mm-hmm. And then, so yes, Adventureland all the way.
You just like enlightened us because we are people that say Tiki Room, but you're right. We need to call it its correct full name, Walt Disney's Enchanted Tiki Room.
Normally, I'd make you raise your right hand and take the pledge, which everybody I do. But, and here's the thing. It's the same thing with Walt Disney World, mm-hmm. is that, you know, for the first time of the day with Walt Disney's Enchanted Tiki Room, I ask you to use the full attraction's name that of the day. And if you have the opportunity to help somebody else to understand that during the day, bonus. But then you can abbreviate it because let's face it, you know, it's long.
Yeah, it's like Star Wars, Galaxy's Edge, or Millennium Falcon Smuggler's Run. Like, nobody calls it the full
name. No one's going to do that. Yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah. All right. Well, we might already know this, but what is your favorite attraction? Now, even though we are a Disneyland podcast, you can choose any attraction from any of the Disney parks.
Yeah, I love that question because there's so many. I have not been to Tokyo or Tokyo Disney Seas or Shanghai yet. So, you know, I feel like I would probably have to have been to all the parks to pick outside of Disneyland, the crown jewel. It's Pirates of the Caribbean, and it goes back to my grandfather. My grandfather was Italian, and whenever he ate a fresh fig or a piece of provolone or mortadella from Domingo's Deli, he would say, oh my God. He just the way he said it, just like that. I can't sing, but dun, dun, dun. So when we would get on Pirates, and then we would be in, you know, the scene and there was the auction scene. And then he'd see the leg with the hair on it. He would say, oh, my God, every time as he was looking at the attraction. So I can't help but, you know, I think of him every time.
Yeah.
I write it. And also, you know, it's just a lot of people. That's what's so fascinating to me about the Disney culture. If you say, what's your opener, what's your closer? No one even has to go further than that. They know exactly what you mean. So yes, Pirates of the Caribbean.
So I always ask a follow-up question when people say Haunted Mansion or Pirates. And what, other than your personal memories with it, what is it about Pirates that you think makes it so popular still to this day that has given it its power to be people's favorites even now?
So many things. I mean, it's just this, the penultimate storytelling. And as Walt, you know, I remember at some point, somebody said to Walt, oh, there's too many things. He goes, it doesn't matter. They'll hear this part of the conversation. They'll hear that part. They'll see something new. There's just so much to see. The audio animatronics, of course, Mr. Lincoln was spectacular. First audio animatronic attraction was Walt Disney's Enchanted Tiki Room, but it's so stellar. And I think the length helps a lot too, because you really get to settle in and enjoy it. I think for so many people, because it was Walt's last fully realized attraction that he worked on, it holds very, like myself, holds very special memories. And it's just freaking brilliant. I mean, everything about it, to think that that team, you know, from the moment you enter and you hear it, I mean, what's the deal with these candles that smell like the chlorinated water?
Yeah. Yeah.
What? But so I think anything like, you know, when you get that memory that it's overused now in social media, but that core memory, it just stays with you. And it's the same thing with food. You know, it has to be exactly the way that you remember it, or it's not the same. And Pirates of the Caribbean, other than we will have another conversation about Jack Sparrow. Another conversation. But other than that, remains unchanged. That's pretty wonderful too.
Yeah. Nope. I agree.
Oh, there's, and the
something about it.
Oh. Thing. Yeah. Okay. But not and much over all that time. 66. Yep. 67, excuse me. Yeah.
That's true. We were just talking about this before we started officially recording. We were talking about Behind the Attraction, and that was the first one of the second season was Pirates of the Caribbean. So that was, it's just so good. You're right. It's just so good.
And if you want to hear Marcy on that, she's on episode 4, the food episode.
Yes, she is.
Which we'll promo again at the end of the show. For sure.
Well, speaking of food, I would love to hear how your love of Disneyland and your separate love of food kind of evolved into, you know, your career path that you're on now and writing. Your first book was Eat Like Walt, which is amazing. I just love the concept because it's so unique and it's so different. And like Pirates, it's a Disney book that's kind of held the test of time. People still talk about it and it's been out for a while. So it's not like it's, you know, brand new, the new thing, but people still talk about it. So can you kind of talk to us about that journey?
Well, thank you for that question. The very short version is I used to never speak in front of, you know, more than a few people. I was terrified of it. I live in Sonoma County, and at some point I got a phone call saying, we want to do a live and local show with a person that's kind of known in the community. And I was, for some of my volunteer work, do you want to try out? And I said, no, like I was terrified. But then my surrogate grandfather mentor set used to have an expression he shared with me, take the cookies when they're passed, meaning you don't know when you're getting another cookie. So I tried out with 75 other people, including this guy named Guy Fieri.
Oh, we don't. No one's heard of him.
I beat him, and I got the show, which is the last time that I ever beat Guy at anything. A very good friend. So he would come on my show, trying to get votes for the next Food Network star. And every time we were on together, it was pop, 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 like brother and sister, you know. So like, he said, we have got to work together one day. So when I left News Talk Radio, I had this concept of a radio show that takes place here in Sonoma County, which is the bounty. I mean, we don't just make wine. We, you know, we make the best cheese. We have beautiful seafood, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I said, hey, Guy, I've got this idea about a show. And he immediately said yes. And at that point, he had a Guy's Big Bite and he was starting Diners. Mm. And so we did a show called Food Guy and Marcy for almost 3 years. And then that, when the recession hit, we were a weekend show. We had to end it because radio just tanked. And even with a star like Guy, there was no way to make it, monetize it. So we ended the show. But the quick version is somebody came to me that was a regular on the show named Molly Katzen. And she is a New York Times bestselling cookbook author. And she said, I heard your snacks on your website. Now, snacks was a radio feature that I wrote and produced and voiced, where I would say things like, what does your dog's toy and an artichoke have in common? Why should you take a restraining order out on your chocolate chip cookies? Take a bath with your strawberries. And then it would be sponsored by Food Guy and Marcy, blah, blah, blah. So she heard those, and I'll give you the answer to one of them. And she said, those should be a book. That was a wah, wah, wah moment when I was leaning into this very famous cookbook author saying, that should be a book. For a moment, going back about the chocolate chip cookies, why should you have a restraining order on your chocolate chip cookies? And that led to a book. That became a book called Snacks, Adventures, and Food. When Ruth Wakefield was at Toll House and she was chopping up the chocolate chunks, she thought that those chocolate chunks were going to melt into a big chocolate cookie. So she was shocked when they came out intact. So when she developed the recipe, it was let it rest in the refrigerator for 24 hours, just like a restraining order. And that helps. It makes it bakes more evenly, et cetera, et cetera. So all those snacks, which were meant to tide you over from the break, you know, in radio, became a book thanks to Molly Katzen, set in a supermarket, by the way, before Guy had a freaking show in a supermarket. Okay. So that book comes out and my agent says, what do you want to do next? And I said, I want to write about the food at Disneyland. And then he said, rather asked, the most important question, what are you going to do that's different than Snapchat and Instagram and Facebook? Mm-hmm. And I really kept thinking about that. I was like, that's a very good point. So then I wondered, had Walt intended for the food experience at Disneyland to be immersive and entertaining like the attractions? So had the culinary history ever been written? Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. I mean, not even, the only thing I found was the wonderful Jim Corcus, late Jim Corcus, had written an article about the Red Wagon Inn, but that's an article. He had never, I mean, there was no book certainly exploring the whole history. So when I found this insert for a newspaper in Orange County in 1955, where Walt said, welcome to the kingdom of good eating, where the food's as fabulous as the fun, like Adventureland and Fantasyland, dining at Disneyland is an adventure too. And I said, I still get goosebumps, like, oh my God, wow, I have proof. And so the title was The Kingdom of Good Eating. I got it all the way to who's now my dear friend and editor, Wendy Lefcon, and I sold the book based on the culinary history of Disneyland. And now I get access to the archives because I'm an official Disney Editions book. Now, yes, it's everything you think it is and more. You basically write your letter to Santa Claus and say, dear Santa, dear archivist, you know, I want to see blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Show up. And then there are boxes on your table and you open them up and you see if what you want's in there. So in that research, I just discovered so much, including the fact that Walt's first studios did not have a commissaire. He ate out. But then when he opened his studio in 1940, he had four state-of-the-art restaurants. They were all subsidized, just like we think of Silicon Valley now. They all were then. I mean, he knew he had to have a better price for his employees, and he wanted to feed them well at a lower cost. Yeah. So I had a whole new chapter, the studio. But then the big part was, I know one of Walt's granddaughters as a friend up here in Sonoma County. We'd had dinner three or four times. She would mention grandpa and I'd be under the table electrified. Oh my God, he's just talking to, you know, I love my grandfather too, but he's not Walt Disney, you know? So when I sold the book, I wrote to her and it took me like 3 days because I thought I was like a stalker. And then I said, I sold the book. Here it is. And she said, we wouldn't want anybody else to tell grandpa's story. And I'll introduce you to my dad and my sisters. So I had three sit down long interviews with the Walt Disney family, and that I don't know what's happened to anybody. And that became Walt at Home. And then I realized, wow, I have the culinary history, but what I have is, which is entirely unique, but what I have a bigger piece is I have the way to look at Walt Disney as a human being through the lens of food and to tell stories about him in a way that haven't been able to be told. And what a privilege to have the access to the family, everybody in my books, all my books. First person only. No, my aunt said, no, my mother told me. If I don't speak with the person or read their books or their accounts in the archives, I think first person is critical. So that's how Eat Like Walt happened. And that came out, and thank you for mentioning that about, you know, it has been, it came out September 17. Mm-hmm. Then it fade out, fade in, it's February 18. I wake up, I'm an early riser, and there's an alert from the New York Times. And I look at it, New York Times new and noteworthy Eat Like Walt. And I lean into my laptop. I'm like, mistake, what? And I'm really sure I'm like drinking the coffee. This can't be. I'm like, new in the New York Times. So I called my editor, who's in New York. She's like, oh my God, oh my God. I'm like, oh, this is just the Tuesday online. It's not going to be in the paper on Sunday. This is just like the mercy for the ones that don't make it. It's like, so my point of sharing that is for my grandparents, because they never graduated high school. They played Scrabble every single night. My grandmother did the New York Times crossword puzzle in ink. My grandfather read multiple library books and only library books a week. And if there's any honor I could give to my grandparents, it was that.
Oh, wow.
That's special.
What a great story. And I can't, it's weird to me because I feel like a New York Times list, I feel like your publisher, like, I don't know, in my mind, not being part of this world, I feel like the publisher would know about it. And so you'd get like a heads up so you'd be prepared and not having a coffee moment.
Well, you know, I think the thing is that they don't know. I think that's the beauty of it. I mean, the whole thing is, as I understand it, you know, there's the reporters, and it's intended to be the independent and the big booksellers. And they, you know, so that's how they keep, that's how they work the sales. And then I had no idea how they choose what books they review. I really don't. But I found out later through mutual friends, you know, that there's apparently a pile at the New York Times. This is just my experience in one source. So don't, put it into the context. And that, you know, they, of course, there's certain ones they're tagged to read, but this particular person picked up Eat Like Walt. Of course, there's Walt on the cover, but he didn't. He does say it's a weird or bizarre, you know, he does say that, but I got the notice. Anyway, so that's no, amazing. I don't think they're given, I just like it, because that wouldn't be the integrity to give a heads up, because it's a review. You don't make you a noteworthy unless they like it. So there's that, but.
That's incredible.
Wow. Before I forget, and Teresa's going to make so much fun of me because this has been such a topic of conversation for me, but I figure we're talking to a Disney food expert. So I have to know if you know or could somehow put me in contact where I could find out. At the River Bell Terrace, they had these breakfast potatoes.
Go ahead. I'm channeling you.
These breakfast potatoes. And since they stopped doing breakfast, they brought it back, but it's not the same breakfast potatoes. I need the recipe for these breakfast potatoes.
Okay, so remind me what era this was.
This was early 2000s. This is when you could go and get the steamboat, and it had like you could get the Mickey-shaped pancake, and you could get the breakfast potatoes on the side, the sausage and bacon. You'd walk up and you'd order, and then you'd see it all made in front of you, and you'd grab it and go sit down. I love these potatoes. Every time I've gone to Disneyland and seen breakfast potatoes on the menu, I've ordered them, and none of them are that recipe. And Teresa thinks I'm ridiculous. One time on the podcast, I put out there that I would pay somebody $100 if they could get me this recipe, and nobody peeped.
Okay, so I am looking in my Spidey database. Let's see. Okay, so to let your listeners know, there's a couple of ways to do this. One is pretty remarkable, and I found out from my friend Oscar, who was 60 years at Disneyland at the Carnation Cafe.
Yeah.
It used to be, back in the day then, and definitely in 2000s, you could go to City Hall and pretty much ask for any recipe that was in Disneyland, and they would give it to you. They'd give you a piece of paper, but it would be quantity, so you would have to figure out how to, you know. Now, if you go to D23 and recipes, put that in the search bar, I cannot tell you how many Disney Parks recipes are there. Lots and lots and lots. Obviously, not them all. So I would start there. And then if you could reach Carlos, who was in behind the attraction, somebody like a Carlos who's been around for a long time, Sakaris, and ask him. And he's the kindest, most loving person. I'm not trying to call him out because I really don't know if he answers fan mail, but he's such a good guy. He may know. That would be my best advice. But you know what? Hey, consider that my new mission. I love a good research project. So
it's so funny because we'll move on. I'm sorry. But like what made these so great is they had like peppers and onions with them too. But like the inside was soft, but the outside was crunchy. It's like what we love the most about a churro, the Disneyland churro. It's crunchy on the outside, soft on the inside. The Disney World churros are just not as good. But like these potatoes, and they had like, I don't know, there was just something about them, and I have fond memories of them. And when River Bell Terrace stopped doing breakfast, I was devastated.
But see, then, go ahead.
And then I heard they were coming back. At, like, breakfast was coming back to Riverboat Terrace, but there's no breakfast potatoes.
So you are making my point that how closely we associate the parks with our memories, and when it changes, we are not happy because it is not what our brains are wired to like. I don't know. I know with other things like Oscar's potatoes were taken off the Carnation Cafe menu too. So I respect the fact that they feel like they need to, you know, new people come in and position and food and beverage, and they're putting their stamp on it and innovation. People think I'm married to the way that Walt ate and Walt's recipe. I love the innovation. The innovation they did at the Crystal Palace at Walt Disney World for the 50th anniversary that lasted 18 months. A lot of it was research from Eat Like Walt, and they didn't use the exact recipe other than Fufu's green beans, by the way. But what they did was they took twists like Walt loved butterscotch and Walt loved popcorn. So they made butterscotch pudding and they put caramel popcorn on it. I thought, that's great. Of course we know. We don't even have to say to your audience, to your listeners, we know that Walt always was looking to the next thing. So your potatoes may be a thing of the past. Rest in peace, potatoes. But I will.
I just want the recipe. I want to be able to make them at home. I know Disney doesn't want to have them, but somewhere somebody is alive on this planet that knows this recipe, and I just need to know what it is. Anyway.
Challenge accepted. Challenge accepted.
Okay.
I will say, to kind of tie that back into the book and Walt.
I'm sorry, Teresa.
No, you're okay. When we were at the Dreaming Tree Gala, he went this crazy about the apple pie that was served for dinner there. So that's, and that was.
I think that was the best apple pie I've ever had in my life.
Well, that was in Marceline, Missouri, Walt's hometown.
Yep.
And that recipe did not make it into Eat Like Walt because I hadn't really made deep connections in Marceline like I have now, including I have property on Main Street. So stay tuned on that. But that is his mother's apple pie recipe. That is Flora's and Walt's mother, Flora. And they were made from Wolf River apples that were grown on the Disney family farm. And like when times were tough, Walt would take those apples with his family and sell them. But times were always tough for them in Marceline. But that was among the many things he did, along with selling his mother's butter. So I think you are making the example of why sense of place is so important to the taste of food. Yes, you spend more money for something at Disneyland, but it just tastes better because you're at Disneyland. And you know that you're paying more for it because you're paying for the atmosphere. You're paying for the music. You're paying for the theming. You're paying for the experience. And so I think partly why I think the pie just tastes better there because we were on the Disney family farm and Walt Disney's mother apple pie recipe with the apples that were grown on the farm. And we were together celebrating Walt and Marceline, and all those things came to make that experience better. But I will be able to share Flora's recipe with y'all soon. So stay tuned.
Perfect. So the first thing I want to ask about is there was a time, and I think you would probably agree with this. There was a time 15 years ago, 20 years ago, that the food at Disneyland was actually not very good. There was kind of a dark time where it was very expensive, like it still is, but it wasn't very good. I remember going to the Blue Bayou and not being very happy with my food. So as a Disney historian and food being kind of a thing, what kind of happened there? Did Disney, what precipitated this change? Because they have amazing food now. And we get their foodie guides. And in fact, in the new year, we're starting a whole new segment on the show that's just going to be about food. And people love talking, Teresa especially loves talking about food. But like, we love talking about food. So like, did something happen? Or, I mean, the historical?
Well, I have to be really clear. First of all, I don't refer to myself as an expert. You know, sure. I am aficionado, number one. Number two, when I sold Eat Like Walt to Disney, that was October 2015. So I have a very steep trajectory, but I really have a very narrow focus, which is Walt Disney and Walt's era of Disney. Sure. But that's why Eat Like Walt was purposely a time capsule of his life. It does end in 67 because of Pirates of the Caribbean, Blue Bayou opening and Club 33. Mm-hmm. Teresa, you said it best, maybe that's part of the staying power is because it's not current. It's a time capsule, right? So I really can't speak to that because I don't know enough about Disneyland food other than Walt's era. And now, like for the new book that just came out, Delicious Disney, the Disneyland book, I had, you know, I was so excited to do the Walt Disney World 50th cookbook with Pam Brandon, because I wanted to write the narrative and talk about Walt and, you know, tell stories is what I do and combine our talents. But when this came out that they wanted to do the same for Disneyland, I was writing the National Geographic 100 Disney Adventures of a Lifetime in a year with no break. And so I could not, you know, participate. So I said, oh, I'll do sidebar. So the reason I say that is Disneyland will always be my number one. Of course, I want to be a part of a book that's about Disneyland and food, but that's just not, I don't know that much better other than we could talk for days about what I ate, liked, didn't like. So I, you know, and again, I would defer to Carlos. I think Carlos would be a great guest for you.
Cool. Yeah. Sorry about that. Yeah. I was curious.
Don't
what your
sorry.
Thoughts
ask
were.
Me anything. Yeah.
No, that's all right.
So we've talked about Eat Like Walt, and then after Eat Like Walt was Walt's Disneyland, which is also another book that I feel, and maybe you said it best, it's like
book.
A time capsule, but you know, it's just another one that has staying power and is still very popular. So kind of how did you go from eating like Walt to looking at Disneyland through Walt's point of view?
I mean, to walking like Walt, people said, are you going to call it Walk Like Walt? I'm like, I kind of like that, you know? Yeah. So thank you for the question. Jim Cora, Disney legend Jim Cora, was my mentor. Marty Sklar introduced me to him and we became fast friends. And I have so much to owe to him. Every introduction, so much enthusiasm and help and this wealth of knowledge. If he didn't know, he would introduce me to somebody. So much so, at some point, he started calling himself my intern. and he really did. If you knew Tony, he was so smart and so funny, but so sarcastic. So one time at Walt Disney Family Museum, I referred to Jim as my intern, and somebody on Instagram said, and the diva thinks that Disney legend Jim Cora is her intern. And yeah. I sent it to Jim, and Jim writes back, yeah, I am. So anyway, so Jim and I were having lunch, as we did at Biblos. By the way, shout out to Biblos in Orange, which is our favorite place. After Eat Like Walt, and he said, what are you going to do next, kid? And I pitched a couple ideas. And then I said, I have an idea for doing a souvenir, you know, in air quotes, souvenir guidebook to Disneyland told in Walt's words, or the people that built Disneyland with them. The distinction being that there are so many fantastic fact-based books about Disneyland. We don't need another fact-based book. I concentrate in all my writing about feelings and emotion, what Walt wanted you to feel when you were in his parks, what Walt wanted you to feel when he was watching, when you're watching his movies. And so that was my pitch, you know, first person told in Walt's words, and also really to evoke feeling and ensure legacy. So he said, that's one you got to do. And he made all these introductions, including to Bob Weiss, who was the president of Imagineering at the time. And I said further, when I was making the deal, I said to Jim, I think I'm going to say it should be paperback. Mm-hmm. So it's affordable and portable. And he's, you know, you're shooting yourself in the foot, kid. It should be, you know, but no, he agreed. I mean, because coffee table books, in a way, people take that more seriously. I think that because it's a paperback, some people just might think of it as more casual. I assure you, Eat Like Walt took me 3 years of research and writing. I don't mean 3 years part-time. I mean 3 years every day with Sundays. And same thing, Walt's Disneyland. And part of it during the pandemic, but luckily I had all my archives, research, and scans so that I could do it. And that was a decision I made. I was very important to me because I wanted Walt's legacy to be ensured. Also, in the back, there's 13,000 words in endnotes. Now, this was important to me. I learned a lot with Eat Like Walt and sources. I kept meticulous track of sources. I did do a bibliography, et cetera, et cetera. But now I'm realizing, as reading and talking with folks like you, there is a perpetuation of myth and misquotes and whatever. So I wanted anybody that's truly interested in Disneyland and Walt Disney's era of Disneyland history to be able to go back to that book and have the source and go exactly. So I hired a master's of library and information science to compile them. My friend Paula Sigmund Lowry, that was just is the curator for the Disney 100 exhibition and worked very closely with Dave Smith, oversaw my end notes. It was edited by Ed O'Valley and Kevin Kern in the Walt Disney Archives. I mean, guys, and it's not even the book. So that's how seriously I took it. Yeah. Very, very proud of that book. And thank you for bringing it up. And that's how, well, you know, Walk in the Park with Walt Disney.
That's incredible.
I love this book. I had it on my nightstand for a while because I don't, when it comes to books, it's hard for me to find time to like read books. But this one I got, I think, for Christmas. I think it was on my Christmas list, and I got it. And it sat there, and I would read, like, a little bit. And it was really tough for me because I didn't want to put it down. I just wanted to keep reading. It's one of those books that you pick up, and you're like, well, this is fascinating. I got to keep going. So I think I got about halfway through the book in, like, one or two nights because I just kept, I didn't want to put it down. But then I was like, you got to go to bed, Tay. So...
That's a high compliment. I really, truly, truly appreciate it.
No, it's a beautiful book. When we go to Disneyland events and stuff, Teresa's way better at this than I am. But, like, I'll buy a book with every intention to read it, and then it just sits there. but this one was on my list, and I did read it. So it's a very, very good book. And I highly recommend all of our listeners go out and buy a copy because it is a great book. In fact, buy all of Marcy's books. They're all wonderful.
Looks like we're coming in for a landing, gang. But please stay listening until trivia comes to a stop. And then yous can walk to the nearest exit. Thanks for listening to the 8th Wonder of the World, Dia Weekly.
Welcome back to Trivia Land. Ugh, always wanted to say that. Let's go over our answers.
I'm filled with existential dread for how terribly we did.
I've just accepted it.
Well, I mean, you should maybe feel a little bad. I mean, this is a religious event, and you don't know anything about it.
And we've burst into flame.
All right. Question number one was the first candlelight processional, which included a celebrity narrator reading portions of the biblical Christmas story, took place in 1960. Who was the first celebrity narrator and how many years did he or she narrate the event? James, you said Burl Ives for 7 years, and Tag, you said Bing Crosby for 3 years. The correct answer was the actor Dennis Morgan. And he did so for 6 years, from 1960 to 64. And then he came back one more time in 1966.
I was close with the number of years.
Yeah.
You were, 1965 was Dick Van Dyke. So
Dick Van Dyke. I didn't even think about him.
I thought for sure one of you guys would think of Dick Van Dyke.
That makes a lot of sense.
I always feel like when I ask people trivia questions, like when we play like board games and stuff with trivia questions, I always feel like as the asker, like it seems so obvious, just pick this.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're on the other side, no.
Oh, no,
it's
hard to come up with this stuff out of thin air.
Yeah.
Okay. Question number two was the candlelight processional at Disneyland typically takes place over 2 nights at Disneyland, but 1 year the event was expanded to 20 nights. What year did this expansion take place and how many different celebrity narrators performed over the 20 nights? Tag, you said 2018 and 8 narrators. James, you also said 2018 and 5 narrators. The year was 2012.
That long ago?
It was that long ago, yeah.
I guess you did.
And there were 9 celebrity narrators that year.
9? That was close. You know what, though? You know what I'm remembering it from? Because I reported on it. It was when I first started the YouTube Disneyland Weekly. Because I remember now that you say that, I remember the graphic I made because I had to make a graphic with showing like all the dates and everything. Oh my goodness.
So the 9 narrators that year were Dennis Haysbert, Kurt Russell, Edward James Olmos, Lou Diamond Phillips, Dick Van Dyke, Patricia Heaton, John Stamos, and Molly Ringwald.
Of course, Doug.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Unfortunately, the outdoor event had to be canceled several times due to inclement weather. So they reverted back to the 2-day format the following year. And it's been 2 days ever since.
Yeah, I was wondering why they got rid of that, because I know that it's such a hard event to attend that giving them more nights would allow more people the opportunity to see it. However, it's also like a nightmare for the park.
Yeah, and I think it's held right at the front of the park.
Yeah. Have you ever seen outdoors. It?
I haven't. I have reservations on Sunday this year, so I don't know. We'll see if I'm up for it.
I've watched
videos
like
of it. No, I'm not going to camp out, but I might try to get like a side view from like way, way in the back. We'll see.
Part of me wonders if they could figure out how to do it over on like the Small World stage instead, but I feel like that's probably a little too small and not...
There's no state. Oh, you mean like in the Fantasyland Theater?
I mean that
they did it.
Too.
They did it in the Fantasyland Theater for 1 or 2 years. It might Might have just been 1 year.
But I think part of the point that's cool is that it's on the train station. Like the fact that they, you know, it's like the Fantastic Argument that I have.
Yeah. It's beautiful. I'd love to see it. It's definitely a bucket list item, but I'm too much of a princess to camp out for 8 to 12 hours.
They should put the choir on the Mark Twain and it could go like Fantasmic and just slowly go around.
Stop it. Just put on the Fantasmic stage. There you go. 10,000 people could watch it at once.
Perfect. There you go.
That's
solving all the parks problems every week.
That's what we're here for.
Yes. Yes, it is. Okay. So question number three was approximately how many choir members will be singing at this year's processional? And you were both correct with about 600 choir singers. The choir includes members of the cast choir as well as community choir groups.
I want to be one of those trumpeters on top of the roof, though. They're cool.
They are cool.
I'm just excited I proved I could read a news article.
Good job, James.
All right. And the final question was, I named five different former narrators, and you needed to name the year that they narrated the event. So the first one was Olympia Dukakis. Teg, you said 1988, and James, you said 1993. The correct year was 1999.
Crap. You were in the right decade. I got another one wrong.
Well, you were in the right decade.
I feel like Olympia Dukakis's career was like 80s, 90s, and beyond. So that makes sense. Number two was Jimmy Stewart. You both said 1971. You were close. You guys were really close. The correct answer was 1975.
Oh, okay. Not bad.
Not bad.
Yeah. Number three was Chris Hemsworth. Teg, you said 2021, and James, you said 2014. Kind of right in the middle there, the correct answer was 2017.
Yes, I'm closer.
Dang it. You are closer. All right. Good job.
Yeah. Number four was Craig T. Nelson. And let's see, Teg, you said 1993. James, you said 1999.
So I'm definitely right.
We're a little late on that one. It was 1986.
Way off.
And then finally, we had Charleston Heston. And you guys were both close, really close again. Teg, you said 1969. James, you said 1968. The correct answer was 1970.
Oh!
So close.
Charlton Heston, man, he was, if you haven't ever seen it, and I know there's probably people listening, they're younger, they're going to be like rolling their eyes, but the original Planet of the Apes was really good.
It was good.
In fact, I would even say some of the sequels to it were also not god awful. Not all of them.
I don't know that I've ever seen anything other than the original.
Oh, there was like five or six of them because I watched them when I was a little bit younger. I watched them all because there was like Rise of the Planet of the Apes, Beneath the Planet of the Apes, Return to the Planet of the Apes. There was like all these different things. And for those of you listening, we're talking about the ones from the 60s and 70s, not the one recent, which are not bad, but they're not.
I liked the first one. I thought it was a good take on updating the story.
Yeah.
And we haven't watched any since. So, well, Kate, thank you for stepping in and stumping us very well, but giving us at least 1 point. So that feels very, very good. If you have questions you want to submit, perhaps send them in to us. Maybe even we could try something new and send in a voice memo of you reading the question and the answer, and we could try to figure out how to get that in there. Why not? This could be fun. New year, almost new us. We'll see how it goes.
I love how you're just throwing this out there live. Okay.
It's Trivia Land. We have no rules here.
I guess.
You're building a neighboring land to us. I got to stay relevant.
Yeah.
Yeah. So send producer Vern and I guess maybe even occasionally Kate, who knows? Send us an email. It's trivia@dlweekly.net. And we'll be back next week with more Disneyland news and information.
Until then, go out and enjoy the parks.
And thank you to our editor, Sadell, for masterfully editing this episode and making sure all the show notes are posted.
Please remain seated until the podcast comes to a complete stop and the doors have opened. Then collect your belongings, watch your head, and step carefully from the episode. On behalf of all of our crew, thanks for traveling with us. And we hope you have a happy and memorable visit here at DL Weekly.